Today on the 21st Show, novelist Shelby Van Pelt was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, but now she makes her home in Illinois, in the suburbs of Chicago. Her debut novel, called Remarkably Bright Creatures, is about an octopus who forms a bond with an aging woman still grieving her son's disappearance many years ago. The book has been a huge success, reportedly selling more than 2 million copies. It's also being made into a movie by Netflix. We'll talk with Van Pelt about her life and work. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington-Normal, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. 80 years ago this past May, at a school in Reims, France, German Army Field Marshal Jodl signed a five-paragraph Act of Military Surrender. The Supreme Allied Commander sent word to President Harry Truman.
General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. Much remains to be done. The victory won in the West must now be won in the East. The whole world must be cleansed of the evil from which half the world has been free.
The Russians wanted the surrender documents signed again in Berlin, and that happened the next day, May 8, 1945. It would be known as VE, Victory in Europe. There would be 3 more months of fighting in the Pacific before victory over Japan, but it was the beginning of the end of the greatest calamity ever to befall humankind. The war, the victory, the peace, and the hold it all has on the modern imagination is the subject of our show that we're hearing again today. Peter Fritchie joined me for the hour back in May. He's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of multiple books on the Second World War, including Hitler's First 100 Days, When Germans Embraced the Third Reich, published in 2020. His most recent book is 1942, When World War II Engulfed the Globe. Because our program's on tape today, we're not taking calls, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. All right, let's begin by talking about what was happening in Europe in the days leading up to May 8th, 1945.
Well, most of Europe had been liberated, and I say that with quotation marks because the Soviet Red Army came from the east, and then the American and British, to some extent French forces, came in from the west. The great majority of Europe had been liberated in the previous 8-9 months. So what was left in these last weeks was really a circle around Berlin. What the Allies didn't know was whether or not there would be an underground movement trying to continue to fight for the Third Reich or not. And so the surrender was important on May 8th, but it was very clear Berlin had fallen on May 2nd, and there was not much left of a regular German army.
So what were the scenes like across Europe and the United States when news of Germany's surrender broke?
Well, there would have been immense celebration, especially in Western Europe. It was not only the end of the German occupation, it was the end of the war that had every winter in that war since 39 was cold. People were deprived. The last winter, 44-45, was associated with food shortages, especially in Holland. The worst of the bombing came in the last 8-9 months of the war in Italy and France, as well as Germany. So it was the end, of deprivation, the hope that people would be reattached. There were more than 500,000 French prisoners in Germany. So this would be a family reunion. It was the end of the war.
big celebration. I wonder if you'd indulge me. I have here a couple of letters that my grandfather wrote home. He happened to be in Paris. He was in France. He was somewhere in France. He had just been moved there. He had been recovering from a wound in England. And he happened to go down to Paris on what turned out to be VE Day. And I thought if I could just share a little of what he had to say. I was in to see Paris last night. It was Victory Day, you know, and I never saw so many people in one place in all my life. They turn out in Chicago all right, but yesterday being VE Day brought them all out to this one place, it seemed. He goes on to say they had the buildings lit up, planes were flying overhead, dropping skyrocket fireworks, etc. Some kept coming in and zooming down low right over the city. People in the side streets were gathered at some corner where loudspeakers were set up and were blasting music all over the place. Some were singing, others were dancing right out in the street. Ultimately, though, he says, and this is in a second letter he writes the next day, reflecting on it, the people were really joyous about the whole thing. Personally, I didn't feel at all like something big had taken place. To me, it was all like some kind of holiday or festival. I suppose I'm glad that it is over because now we can start our work over there sooner, but it still will be a long time yet before we can think of going home. So I wonder if you could talk about what life, so that's the American soldier's perspective. What would life have been like for, say, the average French person or German as this is happening?
Well, let's stick with Paris. So the Germans occupy the city in June 1940. Almost from one day to the next, French troops are no longer visible, and German troops are. They're visible in all the cafes, the main streets, the museums, take photographs, take tours. It's the place to go as a German soldier. There were serious food shortages, daily calories, 1,500, 1,200 for the bad winters of those occupation years. The French were also divided. The French National Assembly had voted for the end of the Constitution, the end of the Third Reich, and for Pétain in July 1940. Most French were guardedly for the collaborationist government with the Germans, and then moved over the successive years to be guardedly against them. So people had very different family autobiographies. And as I mentioned, many French soldiers were still in Germany as prisoners. There were also several hundred thousand French workers, some voluntary, most not, who had been brought to Germany to work in German factories. So many, many French people, many Parisians were looking forward to a reunion, but hadn't had one yet. The end of the war is the beginning of all of this. Mm. Their families in France, where the Jewish mom, the Jewish dad had been deported, and there's hope on May 8th that they'll come back. This is the great hope among the few Jewish survivors, that they will find their relatives. And the hard news of that summer is that they won't. And at a certain point, there's a young girl who holds a sign up at the Gare du Nord in Paris. Every day she goes as the workers return, the ex-soldiers return, hoping that among them will be her mom. And the mom doesn't come. And one day, the daughter no longer goes to the train station with the sign because she's now accepted that her mom won't come back. This was the summer of 1945 for many people to realize that the displaced, the refugees, the deported were dead.
It wasn't clear yet that ultimately, 60, 70 million people possibly had been
around the world, 70 million people, yeah. But there were a few Jewish survivors, but there were basically none. And if you were deported in 42, 43, certainly that would be very, very rare.
Yeah. I was reading through Klimperer's diary last night, mid-May 1945. He's without power, without radio news. It wasn't even clear to me that he understood the war was over. It was just a lot about the deprivation that they were experiencing. What was the immediate aftermath like for civilians on the Axis side after the surrender?
Well, there's no better diary of these years than Klemperer's. And I was reading it last night, too. It's really an extraordinary document. When Dresden was bombed in mid-February 1945, there was so much destruction that he could pass as a so-called Aryan German without papers. And certainly that was the fate of thousands and thousands of people in Dresden. And so he...
Maybe we should tell listeners he was...
He's Jewish, yeah. But he is surviving because his wife is not Jewish. But he's been called up for work, and he doesn't know what that means. So he has to register, a couple days later. But suddenly there's the bombing, and nobody has papers. There's total confusion. The Nazi social affairs committees kick in. They're given food. They're given finally proper ration cards for so-called Aryans. And the first thing they do is they go out into the countryside. They leave that city. They leave places where they might be seen and known. And they're basically in a semi-underground waiting for the end. And so May 8th would have been psychologically a day of great happiness for him. But you're still scrounging for food every day.
Yeah, he wrote of his wife's suffering from lack of tobacco acutely as well in that time. Let's talk about some of the bigger picture ideas around VE Day, because a lot of us still think of this as a good war. You recently described the outcome as murky. What did you mean by that?
Well, first of all, it is a good war in many ways. The global enemy were aggressive militarist fascist states that were destructive to their neighbors and to their own citizens. The war is murky because we, too, were not simply democratic powers fighting for liberty and freedom. And that became very clear on the first day of American mobilization, which was Monday, December 8th. All sorts of volunteers came to recruiting stations in Chicago or in Detroit. And if they were African-American, they were often turned away. They didn't want those American volunteers. And when their moms wanted to give blood, they were turned away as well, because the American Red Cross was told by the War Department that they didn't want so-called Negro blood. And so very clear, unfreedom and not democracy and its limits became very clear in the United States. And there are many other, examples. The very fact that we allied with the Soviet Union is not unambivalent, as people noted then and still note today. So there is murkiness, and I think that's the legacy of World War II. Good that we won, but we all have divided and shaded memories, just like those Parisians in May 1945. They might have celebrated Pétain, the collaborationist leader, 3 or 4 years earlier, but now they were celebrating de Gaulle.
You say in a piece recently in Foreword, World War II haunted so many survivors because it showed the degree to which they were both part of the Allies and part of the Axis. They could be both oppressors and oppressed. And it is this tainted inheritance, you write, that we must still try to figure out today. The murky outcomes of the war compel us to examine why people do the things they do. Talk about that and how... You know, this period is still a lens through which we're trying to understand ourselves today.
Well, let's take the conspirators against Hitler on July 20th, 1944. As aristocrats, they were privileged in pre-World War I Germany. As young adults with military careers, many of them supported Hitler in 1933. But at a certain point, lines were drawn, moral lines, as well as practical lines, that led them to oppose Hitler and oppose the Third Reich, not necessarily in the name of democracy, but in the name of getting rid of this dictatorship and that cruel leader. They did so with a tainted biography, with tainted autobiographies. They had supported Hitler in 1933 against the Social Democrats, who who were people they would have never voted for, never consorted for, but who were the only Democrats in Germany in 1933. And when they opposed Hitler in 1944, not only did they know that they risk a gruesome death, a very gruesome death, but they risked their family lives. So there's tremendous bravery and resolution. But these were also tainted biographies. This is something that comes up in the public speeches of the president of Germany in the 1980s, Weizsäcker, who's well aware of what his father did. His brother dies very early in the Polish campaign in 1939. And so he could speak from his own family's history about the tainted histories. And how, and it's precisely that that allows a depth of conviction about the importance.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're listening back to my conversation with Peter Fritchie, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He has many books on the Second World War and the Holocaust and fascism, including Hitler's First 100 Days when Germans embraced the Third Reich, and also 1942 when World War II engulfed the globe, which came out in September of this year. Our program's on tape for the hour, so no calls, but you can join our texting group. You do that by sending the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation on the 80th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe, when the German forces unconditionally surrendered to the Allies. My guest for the hour was Peter Fritchie. He's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author of multiple books on the Second World War, including Hitler's First 100 Days. No calls today, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address, talk@21stshow.org. What drew you to studying this period in your book, Hitler's First 100 Days? What is it about 1933 that still is so important for us to try and understand what was happening?
In January 1933, it's also a cold winter, you have a divided country, terribly clearly divided. You have communist hunger marches in the main boulevards. You have big Nazi rallies. The Nazis have never gotten over 40%. So they're the biggest party. They're the biggest thing that's happened in German politics. But they do not have a majority. And there have been multiple votes over the year, 1932. Indeed, in the last elections, they've slipped even. And it's just, so you come from this divided Germany, and a hungry Germany, unemployed Germany, and then 4 months later, you seem to have unanimity. And how do we understand that? One historian calls it, how did the majority of the majority side with Hitler? Even in the last elections, on March 5th, 1933, the Nazis get, with their coalition partners, 52%, so 42% are not voting. So you have Catholics, socialists, communists not voting for Hitler. And yet there's no question that 75% of the population more or less supported Hitler in the coming months and years. How do we understand that? This has not been settled. So we political scientists, we historians, we pursue our studies, but everybody has to, in a way, suss it out for themselves. What is our own political science, our own social studies about why people do the things they do? Out of fear, they're concentration camps. Out of losing your job if you say the wrong thing. Out of opportunism, there's new jobs in the bureaucracy, new possibilities for professional development. The economy is starting to reactivate. Out of conviction. Sometimes we don't imagine that people do things out of love and desire and very much think that a new page in German history is being written. Well, how do these motivations work? How important are they? How deep are they? How do they change over time? I think in one diary, this guy says, oh, this guy did it because he's a weakling. He does it for opportunism. And then there's a self-correction in the diary, ideology. So the diarist changes his mind about his friend, who then is put in from the opportunist column to the ideology column. So people at the time are figuring this out. What did Heil Hitler mean? Does it mean you've crossed over and become a Nazi? The Nazis didn't think, though. They saw everybody Heil Hitlering, and yet they knew that they had only gotten 40% of the votes a year earlier, and they thought a lot of these people were just fair-weather Nazis. And so they were trying to figure out, we're trying to figure out, what does it mean when people vote for a much more radical or a very different kind of political alternative? What is the mix of fear, opportunism, and love?
Yeah, and it's striking reading about, you know, reading your writing about this period, how much resonates with things we've heard recently. But, you know, it's worth noting that the Germans were definitely not a monolith, as people are not, right? Some liked the eugenics. Some didn't like the Jews. Some just wanted a job. And maybe you could talk about that and, you know, the ways that people were Nazis or supported the Nazis for lots of different reasons. And maybe the number who were actually on board with the full program was pretty small.
It's very difficult to find 100% fanatic and 100% someone who's 100% resistant. And even my mother's parents, they were socialists. They didn't like the Nazis at all. But they're living there in 34, 35, 36. They don't know that 1945 is coming. They don't know they have to just wait it out, plus the terrible war. They think this is the future, and people have to orient themselves to it. Ditto in East Germany. For my wife's family, East Germans may not have liked East Germany. They could certainly see what just West Germany was like on the TV. But this was it. This was where you were going to grow up. This was where you're going to have a job, have a career, fall in love. I have children and grandchildren, and so you have to adjust to that. That's that reality. No one's just going to become few people become dissidents. And so it was in the Third Reich. And yet the Nazis did have something about them that attracted people. They seemed to embody the nation. They seemed to be idealistic and resolved, dynamic. They were young. They had particular support among students in the university and young people in general. And seemed to marry both a social conscience where the we was more important than the I, the nation more important than the neighborhood, with a patriotism that seemed to give Germany pride after the lost war.
Is there something about the German people that I think at the time the term was the authoritarian personality? Now I think political scientists say the authoritarian tendency. Was there something unique about the German people and their affinity for this authoritarian leader?
Enough so to keep us researchers in the field amused with jokes about that. But I think you have to work against that. When one looks how quickly Americans fall into line on certain aspects of law and order, or other countries as well. Germany was also the home to the largest socialist party in the world, the Social Democratic Party, which is a moderate socialist party that was completely pro-Republican and working for the Republic and for the extension of social democracy. So there's lots of different kinds of Germany. The Nazis also thought of themselves as dissidents and were. before they came to power, when they were struggling for power, they were not the charmed boys that then they became in the 1930s. They saw themselves as dissidents and were treated as dissidents. So I think it's too quick to talk about the authoritarian personality. And when we think about other bureaucratic structures, imprisoning people, taking people off the streets, people are following orders. That's what they say that's what they are doing. That's what German said they were doing as well in 1933, following orders. So I don't know how far that gets you.
You've described fascism as an attraction. I think you even taught a class called the Fascist Temptation. What does that mean?
For all its violence, fascism is a movement that is not embedded in the past, but is embedded in the future. And that's what Hitler's Third Reich was about. It was not about nostalgia for the Kaiser. It was not a return for a state of deference and hierarchy and different classes. It was a new kind of public that would where the public coming together would be more than the sum of its parts. And that dynamic would lead Germany into a great future. It wasn't an egalitarian state, but it was clear. It was clearly a state that legitimized itself through the people. Certainly not through the king or through a dynasty, and that was very appealing. And the affinity with the nation, and that the nation was the true subject in history. And that the nation could do great things, not just repair itself at home, but have a global destiny, was also highly attractive.
I guess what I'm driving at is the idea of fascism that was appealing to Germans. Obviously, there have been people who have called President Trump fascist or fascist curious or quasi-fascist, use the term you want. Is what drove voters and everyday people then some of the same ideas that are driving that support today? Or is that parallel overdrawn in your view?
Well, I think all comparisons are legitimate, and comparisons will draw things that resonate and things that don't. I mean, the big difference between 1933 Germany and wherever else you want to compare it to in the present is that you have a mass movement of young people. Some of them are uniformed and armed, highly organized. So it would be the stormtroopers are 400,000 in Germany. So that's the equivalent of 2 million today.
This would be like if the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys or something like that.
A huge paramilitary group.
Uniforms,
marching.
Yeah.
Not only sticking their, not only sticking it to the enemy, but also in their marches, in their church consecrations, in their speeches, promising a new kind of Germany, a more just and a more fair Germany, a democratic Germany. They would turn the page of history and would also get rid of the system that was bureaucratic, the system that had a politics of austerity. Hitler spent the equivalent of $20 billion on sort of a Keynesian program to get the economy going. He was not cutting the government. He was growing the government. And he was animating people to find their place to serve the nation. Of course it's violent. Of course it's anti-socialist. Of course it's intolerant. Of course it's anti-Semitic. But if you wanna think about what is the attraction, why people are voting for the Nazis, they would be completely different, and they seem to know what they wanted, and they seem to be resolved and organized, and in the end, as it was, have Germany's best interests in their heart. And for example, they are anti-Semitic and violent, but they argued for democratic things like what was called a mixed marriage in Germany was a Catholic Protestant marriage. Mm. And they hated this milieu of Catholicism and milieu of Protestantism that just didn't cross over. And they wanted to join these people together as Germans. It's those sorts of things that made the Nazis very attractive and modern.
You recently had another piece. It's a great sort of mic drop headline. I don't know if you wrote that or somebody at the magazine did, but I wrote the book on Hitler's first 100 days.
I didn't write that.
All right. Here's how Trumps compare. So can you talk about that? Because I think that this is something that a lot of people have been thinking about and making some of these comparisons. As people have been, you know, disappeared into foreign prisons, and he's certainly working to consolidate executive power and often ignoring court orders to do so. How are you thinking about that?
Well, I think that these are authoritarians who are speaking in the name of the nation and legitimizing themselves as doing something good for the nation, and that the fate of the nation, I mean, both Hitler and Trump describe the country that before them as a crime scene, and they were going to clean it up, and they were also going to hold the criminals them to account. And in the name of the nation, they were going to work to improve it without regard for the Constitution and for procedure, which means amassing executive authority. Hitler does that in a very dramatic fashion by suspending the Constitution by a parliamentary vote. But in the case of 2025, we have a tremendous expansion of executive powers. It's contested in the courts, but not really contested in action. In order to get something done, when people are asked, what is it that they do like about the current government, they talk, well, at least he's getting something done. And that's really interesting, because we always assume in this day and age it's terribly difficult to get anything done. He certainly has gotten things done. But there are tremendous differences. Hitler was ideological. He had an ideological army behind him, a much more defined program. He was not destroying government, but transforming it and changing who it would work for. He put lots of money into public health as well as rearmament. So it was a somewhat more coherent program. But in terms of how the enemies are treated, it is without the customs of due process.
Without the customs of due process. Interesting. All right. We're going to take another break in a couple of minutes here. But I guess the last thing I want to ask you about on this point is this idea of, and only about a minute here, but, you know, this idea you've also written that, you know, suggesting Trump was a fascist in the campaign only served to sort of like point out the attributes that made him so appealing to people. Can you talk about that sort of trick box or dichotomy, if you will?
I think the best way to put it is that he portrayed America as a crime scene, and he was going to come in and clean it up. And a crime scene means that it's not structural problems, longstanding economic changes, post-industrial. It's really people who have deprived Americans of jobs, who've not been acting in the public interest, and whose behavior is actually criminal. It is with that highly melodramatic view is that he's approaching the United States without a sense of procedure, and I might add, without the soulfulness of recognizing that everybody's different like everybody else.
We're listening back to our conversation with Peter Fritchie, professor of history at the University of Illinois and author of Hitler's First 100 Days, When Germans Embraced the Third Reich. Also, most recently, 1942, when World War II engulfed the globe. That came out this year. We first aired this conversation on the 80th anniversary of VE Day earlier this year. We'll continue to talk about that and some of the lessons of World War II that we are perhaps not heeding sufficiently today in 2025. More to come after a break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. We'll be right back. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're listening back to our conversation marking 80 years since VE Day, May 8th, 1945, when the German military surrendered to the Allies.
Inside Germany itself, the Allies seized the famous Stadium of Nuremberg, scene of countless Nazi party rallies. With the capture of this famous southern German city, the American flag blouts out the swastika. In a symbolic gesture, American troops destroy the Nazi party emblem.
My guest for this conversation was historian Peter Fritchie, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His books on World War II, which are numerous, include 1942, when World War II engulfed the globe, and Hitler's First 100 Days. What are some of the most important lessons of World War II that we are, right now, in 2025, failing to heed?
Well, I think the most important one is that World War II revealed ourselves to ourselves and a kind of humanity that encompassed not only Nazi crimes and Japanese aggression, but encompassed Auschwitz, which means also, it's not just Nazis, it's the indifference of neighbors, the willingness of neighbors to plunder Jewish property. Everyone wants to save people from going to Auschwitz, but few were willing to save Yiddish-speaking refugees in 1938 when they were not condemned to Auschwitz. Auschwitz, Hiroshima, the assembly line use of bombing, so that we were just bombing the ruins in Germany and Tokyo in 1945. And whether you agree with the dropping of the atom bomb or not, that's part of the discussion. That is part of the legacy of World War II. So understanding the difficulties of a decision like the bombing of Hiroshima and understanding our own involvement in being indifferent, being on the sidelines of rejecting refugees in 1938. That is all the legacy of World War II. We talked about the Parisians who celebrated de Gaulle on May 8th, but who may very well have celebrated Pétain two or three years earlier, or the German heroes, really, who finally decided to assassinate Hitler. And yet in 1933, we're in a very different place. It's knowing that complex, murky, gray history, your own history, that I think is the legacy of World War II. It is not just the victory, and a victory it was, and an important one, and it had to be won, the war. But it was also how we were involved in its origins and sustained its prejudices. All that is the legacy. And when Europeans stand up and say, we remember World War II, that's the part they're also remembering. They're remembering their own appeasement. They're remembering the Soviet-Nazi non-aggression pact. They're remembering all of these more compromising moments that are also part of World War II.
It's interesting you talk about that. I had an experience in the United States Holocaust Museum in Washington some years ago. There's a room where it has the photos of one particular village, and I think it's in Lithuania, and it's a multi-story room of all the Jewish people who were obliterated from that village. In my own, I read a letter from my grandfather. His parents were from Lithuania, and I've often thought if they had not come to America, where would they have fallen on that line of complicity and what was happening to their neighbors? Do you get the sense that this is a conversation people like to have? Or, do we reckon sufficiently with this? Do we understand how close all of us might be to becoming collaborators if the circumstances pushed us in that way?
I think it's a very difficult discussion. And I was at a what was called a fireside chat, now also 25 years ago, was with the graduating class in 2000 in Germany. And so they had real memories of East Germany before 1989. And we talked about just these things. As Germans, how do they approach Hitler? As former East Germans, now how do they approach Hitler in the new public sphere of a reunified Germany? But I also asked them, you guys are 18. You know, you guys want to go to Italy and hang out on the beach and meet boys and girls and not be encumbered with being German. And they said, yeah, yeah. And so we talked a little bit about that, how difficult the discussions are. And then they talked until midnight. I had to catch the last subway home. They were still talking when I left. The janitorial staff had come in. The teachers were talking. The students were talking. They were talking about their own past. They were talking about the East German past. They were talking about the Nazi past. They were talking about the relationships between those pasts. They were talking about themselves as victims. They were also talking about themselves as perpetrators or potential perpetrators. So the discussions are hard, but they're necessary. Our grandparents were not only Jews in Lithuania, they were the ones who were oppressing the Jews in Lithuania. And we need to remember that. And these are the discussions that animate Europe. They are difficult, but you need to continue them. You don't have to decide on the issue. And there will be impatience with the questions as part of the discussion. But these discussions have to go on. To say that we are the victors and we are the heroes and that we have done no wrong and that the world owes everything to us is unproductive, unhistorical, and is acting as though you have no soul, no character, no past, no memory. Yourself have no afflictions in your family.
And yet, Europeans were told by our vice president recently that they can stop thinking about the past so much. I'm paraphrasing here at the Munich Security Conference. Do you get the sense, from my understanding, maybe limited, Germany has, by some definitions, done admirably well at reckoning with some of the horrors of its past. Although there are people now who say, you know, that was the past. Let's move on.
The idea that that was the past and let's move on, you could already hear in 1946 and 1947. So it's not a surprise that you're hearing it in 2025. World War II did not start in Germany when Germans started to die and get bombed in 1942-43. It has a prehistory, and you have to go back to 1933. That's what we're talking about on VE Day. And at the same time, European history did not start when Syrian refugees came into Germany in 2015, 2016. And one of the reasons that the government welcomed them, at least initially, was because of the Holocaust. And it's not just the Holocaust. It was the unwelcome reception given to German refugees by Germans. That is to say, German refugees from the East. 25% of the German population was displaced and people moved to the West and had to find new homes in new villages and towns where they were not always welcome at all. And so Germany has its own history of treating people as strangers or as refugees or as unwelcome that goes very deep. It's not just all about the Nazis, but it's about their own hometowns. My own wife's family left Silesia, ended up in Dresden, and many of my other grandparents, they moved with German history from Danzig to Berlin to Frankfurt. Germans understand that history. They might not be for Syrian refugees, but they would understand why that Germany has a refugee policy and has questions and histories regarding refugees. So you can't just say, turn it off, this doesn't exist.
Yeah. Can you talk a little more about your personal family connection? Does that drive some of your interest in this time in history?
Yeah, my entire family is still in Germany, except for my parents who met on the boat as the first batch of Fulbright students in 1950. And my father was born in 1927, so he had already been in the Hitler Youth and then in the youth brigades who did the anti-aircraft batteries and then was in the Wehrmacht, and he deserted. And so he found himself on VE Day on a farm where he'd sort of gone underground and then eventually became part of the Soviet zone. Russian soldiers came over. He himself never saw combat, but he did desert and would have been quite scared until VE Day. But he's still a German soldier, and I think he felt very, very happy on May 8th. But he and his family had many things to reckon with. They had to reckon with that they probably desired that Germany did not lose the war, because losing the war was going to come with lots of problems, not least of which was the accounting of the complicity in the crimes. The crimes of the German army, the crimes of the SS, crimes against Jews, crimes against European civilians in general. There would have to be an accountability for the love of Hitler. And his parents did like Hitler. And accountability for where you were in 1933. So it was going to be an excavation of a lot of history that the people had thought that they had put behind them. So, and then there were years of deprivation in Germany, hardly comparable to what the Germans inflicted on others. But it was, for my father, it was probably a much more joyous day than for the rest of his family and for most other Germans.
You write in the afterword to your book that one of the grandparents didn't even go to the wedding. It was still fresh in 1952.
Yeah, so my father's parents are basically... Are basically fellow travelers with the Nazis. I'm sure they voted Nazi in 1933. I don't know what they did in 32. Certainly not in 1930. But they're basically all for this. And then my father had the regular upbringing of a upper middle class Protestant family. So he would have gone to the Hitler Youth. My father was the youngest son, though, so he didn't like his father. And that means he didn't also like his older brother. And that means he also actually didn't like the Hitler Youth and actually didn't like the German army. And that probably just was his personal makeup. But his parents were kind of conservative. And when they saw my mother, she had lipstick, she had red nail polish, she was cosmopolitan. Intellectuals, family, it was in Berlin. My mother's father was a socialist in the government until he was kicked out. So they had a very different history. These two families had a very hard time coming together. My father's sister was the only one at the wedding. So his parents did not come. And the wedding's in Germany. I mean, they just have to travel to Wiesbaden, for crying out loud. No, they weren't there.
Yeah. Well, all history is personal history, ultimately, I guess.
My family did not suffer.
Yeah.
But these are the divisions that could exist, and then they got re-exposed after 1945, and they persisted because people didn't want to look at their past.
Well, Peter Fritchie, it's been such a pleasure talking with you on this day, VED. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much.
Peter Fritchie is a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's written many books on World War II. They include Hitler's First 100 Days and, most recently this year, 1942, when World War II engulfed the globe. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Cheryl Whitlow Thompson's career in journalism goes back more than four decades to when she was a student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll talk with the NPR senior editor about her journey and the many threats to journalism in America. You can find us anywhere you get your podcasts. We're on Apple, Spotify, even YouTube. You can find us there by searching for Illinois Public Media. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.